Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Russell and Fari, for the opportunity to speak today. It's really a very great pleasure for me to be able to follow both Jamie and Claudio, who I've had the pleasure of working with over the years, and they both have outstanding international reputations, and I think you saw why that's the case this morning. So thank you to both of them for making the long trip out here. Now, as I'm sure you're all aware, over recent years, financial regulators have looked into almost every corner of the global financial system. And too often, they found practices and behaviours that they judged generated unacceptable risks. And in response to that, they've developed a very large and a very complex reform agenda, and much of that agenda is now being implemented. Now, it's understandable why that's taking place. While financial intermediation can be a force of great good in society, it can also do much damage if it's not done well. Indeed, the decisions that were made in some financial institutions in the 2000s ended up causing very real damage to the global economy. These decisions caused many people ultimately to lose their jobs and to suffer a loss of their hard-earned wealth. Sadly, there are also very serious ethical failings by some of the highly paid staff in some of these institutions, and significant taxpayers' dollars had to be put at risk to help solve the problems. The societies in which this has occurred have been, and I think continue to be, rightly angry. And I'm sure you've all heard variations of statements that run something like this: regulators need to make sure that these problems never, ever occur again. Or that not one cent of taxpayers' money should ever again be put at risk to support a financial institution. I suspect many of you in this room would agree with such sentiments. Now, today I'd like to reflect on both of these ideas. I think they're clearly relevant to the theme of this conference: global financial stability and prosperity. In the world of finance, implementing what seem like simple and attractive ideas often turns out to be very difficult. Tensions emerge and trade-offs have to be made. You touch one piece of the financial system and another piece moves somewhere else, sometimes quite unexpectedly. And the views about the public sector's role in the financial system aren't static over time. And all this means it's quite problematic to put into practice what seem like quite simple ideas. So I'd like to start off with the first of these two ideas, and that is that regulators should make sure that the type of financial instability that's been seen in the North Atlantic never, ever happens again. And this idea has motivated much of the reform effort over recent times, and it's entirely understandable. Good, well-designed regulation can make an important difference. This reflects a number of features of financial intermediation, including the existence of pervasive information asymmetries and the potential for runs if confidence is shaken for any reason. In addition, financial institutions and investors seem too often to underestimate risk in the good times, and as Claudio has talked about, that can generate severe consequences for the broader community. And all that means that our societies can benefit from a well-designed set of rules and standards to govern how financial intermediation takes place. At the same time, though, we do need to be realistic about what can be achieved through the application of rules alone. I think history provides some very salutary lessons here. As soon as the ink is dry on one set of rules, perhaps even before the ink is dry, people start trying to find ways around them, and they often have some success in doing so. Now, one possible response to this is to write more rules, and this is sometimes the appropriate response. As we're discovering at the moment, we're rediscovering, as we write more rules, new tensions emerge and new difficult trade-offs become apparent. And I'd like to highlight just a couple of these difficult trade-offs that are evident at the moment. The first arises from the efforts to shift to a system in which a greater share of banks' exposures are collateralised. And this shift is seen in the move to secured funding markets, and covered bonds are a good example of that. It's also seen in initiatives to increase the collateralisation of counterparty exposures in the OTC derivatives markets. Now, a common high-level objective of these changes is to reduce counterparty risk. I think few here would disagree with the idea that this is a sensible objective. After all, if more exposures are collateralised, shouldn't the system be safer? The reality, though, is that there is some uncertainty as to what the effects of this shift will be. And the reasons for this were spelt out in a recent report by the Committee on the Global Financial System at the Bank for International Settlements. This report noted that financial institutions are likely to respond to the increased calls for collateral by changing the way they do their business. Now, some changes are clearly desirable, given that a number of areas' risks were previously underpriced. But if the experience of the past is any guide, as prices change and the demand for collateral increases, financial institutions will seek to manage their collateral more efficiently, and this is likely to increase interconnections in the financial system. The BIS report also noted that greater collateralisation is likely to increase the pro-cyclicality of the financial system and potentially to increase uncertainty about the strength of the claim that unsecured creditors have over the assets of a financial institution. So there are clearly tensions. Reducing counterparty risk is an appropriate objective, but the side effects of doing this could run counter to achieving other high-level objectives, including reducing interconnectedness, reducing pro-cyclicality, as Claudia has talked about, and reducing uncertainty. And the challenge really is to get the balance right so that when we try and fix one problem, we don't create another. Now, a second example of where these tensions between objectives is evident is in efforts to increase the stability of banks' funding. In this context, it's become quite common to think of deposits as good and stable and wholesale funding as bad and unstable. Signs of this thinking are evident in Australia, as they are in many other countries. Many financial institutions have had explicit objectives of increasing the share of their liabilities accounted for by deposits. As a result of this, they've been prepared to pay very large premiums for liabilities that they can call deposits, relative to wholesale funding liabilities of similar maturity. Here and in a number of other countries, this has pushed up banks' overall funding costs and led to increased spreads between lending rates and wholesale rates. Now, I think it is difficult to argue with the idea that a shift towards deposits is helpful for overall financial stability. While you can have a run on an individual bank, a deposit run on the system as a whole is very difficult as deposits tend to get recycled from one bank to another. And in comparison, it's much easier to think of scenarios in which disruptions to foreign wholesale funding causes system-wide stress. But again, there is a balance to be struck here. I think the recent problems in Cyprus give us a hint of this. The Cypriot banks were all very heavily deposit funded, and this turned out to have two distinct disadvantages. The first was that when the value of the bank's assets fell, depositors had to bear the brunt of losses after the equity holders, and this significantly complicated the resolution of the bank's problems. And a similar tension is currently evident in some of the international policy discussions that we're involved in. Some regulators want banks to have more deposit funding because it's seen as more stable. At the same time, others want heavily deposit-funded banks to rely less on deposits and issue certain types of wholesale debt to make it easier to resolve problems should they occur. Now, the second disadvantage is that with only limited wholesale liabilities, the Cypriot banks were arguably subject to less market scrutiny than were banks with a different funding structure. One benefit of wholesale funding is that the issuing bank needs to keep turning up to the market, and it needs to keep selling its story to sophisticated investors. And there's no guarantee that this extra scrutiny will prevent problems, but I think it's arguable that it helps. The general point from both these examples is that there are tensions, and in some cases considerable tensions, in financial regulation. Regulations are introduced to address one issue and another issue emerges. And many countries, including Australia, have had the experience of regulating one aspect of the financial system only for other parts to grow, and sometimes grow quite quickly, and for problems to emerge in those parts. Now, I don't want this to be interpreted as a council of despair, but we do need to be cognizant of the limits of rules alone. It may well be possible that we could design a set of rules that would ensure that the specific problems of recent times are never allowed to occur again. But I think what is much less certain is whether these same rules could ensure that a different set of problems, but with broadly similar dire consequences, do not emerge at some point in the future. I suspect it is simply not possible, or in fact desirable, to regulate a modern financial system to the extent where we can say with absolute confidence that problems will not occur at some point in the future. What we can do, however, is to reduce the likelihood and severity of future problems. But if we are to do this on a sustainable basis, then we need to look beyond the rule-making, as important as that is. In particular, any set of rules needs to be accompanied by strong risk management frameworks, both within financial institutions and within the regulatory community. And a critical element of these frameworks, and thus ultimately to a stable and well-functioning financial system, is the undertaking of holistic risk assessments by those who manage financial institutions and by those who regulate them. These holistic risk assessments are not easy to undertake. They involve an understanding of system-wide issues and detailed disaggregated businesses. But I think, as Claudio has pointed out, neither of these assessments impossible to undertake. While each situation will be different to the one before, there are a number of system-wide variables that do need to be monitored very carefully by both managers of financial institutions and regulators. And these include, but certainly they're not limited to, the rate of increase in the overall level of borrowing in the community, developments in key asset prices, including property, the amount of construction activity in the economy, the pace of innovation in financial products, the degree of competition in the financial services sector, and changes in market-wide lending practices. Obviously, this is only a starting point, and managers of institutions and supervisors need to keep their ears and eyes open for new developments in the financial system. Both need to ensure that the institutions they manage or supervise comply with the rules, but equally importantly, they need to examine what's going on in the system as a whole. In some cases, supervisors' perspectives will differ from those of bank management, and supervisors clearly face different incentives from those facing bank management. Where supervisors reach different judgments, they need to be prepared to use their discretionary supervisory tools to buttress the rules that are in place. And in the end, I think ensuring financial stability requires as much attention to supervision as it does to regulation. I'd like to point out, in this regard, APRA has done a better job than many prudential authorities around the world. It has been able to combine a sensible approach to rulemaking with a focus on the big picture. And it's been assisted in this by the Reserve Bank, with its broad responsibility for financial stability, and the coordination arrangements between the bank and APRA have worked very well. And I think it's fair to say that these arrangements are one of the factors that have helped support Australia's stable financial environment over recent times. Now, I'd like to turn to the second sentiment that I talked about at the beginning, and that's not one cent of public money should ever again be put at risk to help a financial institution. Now, over recent times, there's been a noticeable swing in international policy forums that we attend against the idea that the public sector's balance sheet has a role to play in dealing with financial stress. Many people find it difficult to accept the idea that the very same banks that cause the problems have been supported either directly or indirectly by the public sector. And so a number of the regulatory proposals that are either under consideration or recently been agreed aim to ensure that this does not happen again. Now again, this response is entirely understandable, particularly where such support is seemed to have benefited the management of a troubled bank and or its shareholders. Our societies rightly rail against the idea that those who were responsible for the problems receive some benefit at the expense of the taxpayer. So a better set of arrangements need to be found so that taxpayers are not always drawn into troubles in financial institutions. But at the same time, I think it would be a mistake to reject completely the idea of the public sector using its balance sheet during a period of financial stress or crisis. Indeed, in some situations, the public sector can and arguably should play a stabilising role. Now, one example of this is where the central bank can liquefy assets in a stressed environment. In the first best world of the textbook, all assets are liquid. They can be bought and sold at any time at a fair price. Obviously, the world in which we live isn't like this. Markets are incomplete, information asymmetries exist, and the technology supporting trading is sometimes very expensive to put in place. So we're clearly in a world of second best, and this is suboptimal from a welfare perspective. I think most of the time this deviation from first best is probably not that costly to our society. But in a stressed environment when even high quality assets cannot be bought and sold effectively at any price, this deviation from first best can become very costly. Now, one way of ameliorating this departure from first best is for the central bank to use its balance sheet to liquefy assets in times of stress. And it can do this by purchasing assets under a repurchase agreement with a conservative haircut. In doing so, it can provide liquidity when it is most highly valued and to do so with relatively little risk. As I was listening to Jamie, I thought the role the central bank here was playing was to reduce the liquidation costs. This type of activity, though, should not be viewed a priori as a bailout of the banks. Arguably, it's an efficient solution from society's perspective to a potentially costly deviation from the first best world of complete markets. Central banks, by virtue of their ability to create money, are uniquely placed to deal with such situations. The alternative is for the private financial sector to fully self-insure against these type of liquidity problems. But if the objective is to maximise the welfare of the community in which we live, as it rightly should be, it's far from clear that full self-insurance by the private sector is the right policy. Now, a second example of the public sector playing a stabilising role was provided during the 2008-09 financial crisis when governments issued bank funding guarantees. During that period, risk aversion soared, capital markets shut down, and even well-rated financial institutions found they could not raise funding and provide the critical financial intermediation services that the broader economy relies on. Again, these types of temporary surges in risk aversion can be very costly for society. And again, at least in principle, they can be ameliorated if there's an entity that has a stable risk appetite and that is prepared and financially able to play a stabilising role. Essentially, this was what happened in Australia during the crisis when the Australian government was prepared to ensure bank debt for a fee. The fee was considerably higher than what the market would have normally demanded for providing such insurance, but it was also considerably less than the near infinite fee that the market was then implicitly charging. And then I think there is a strong argument that the Australian taxpayers were well compensated for taking the risk. The insurance premiums paid by financial institutions to date have exceeded $4 billion Australian dollars. And, of course, no money has had to be paid out under these guarantees. A third example in which the public sector can play a stabilising role is through the government underwriting a capital injection for a troubled bank when a very risk-averse private sector is not prepared to do this. This example, I think, is of a distinctly different character than the other two that I've spoken about, and the threshold for action is thus higher. There may, however, be some very limited circumstances where it does make sense for the government to take an institution under public ownership and then later sell it when the risk appetite of the private sector has returned to more normal levels. As, again, as Claudio touched on, in the Scandinavian experience a couple of decades ago, this type of policy worked quite well. I want to emphasise I'm not saying that the Australian authorities would or should behave in a similar way, but rather that such a response should not a priori be excluded from the potential toolkit we have. Importantly, if such a policy were to be used, then private shareholders of the troubled institution as well as the managers would need to be held to full account. Now, the common element in each of these three examples that I've spoken about is that the private sector has swung from relatively normal risk preferences to being temporarily extremely risk averse. And in modern financial systems, these swings in risk aversion can turn out to be very costly to the broader community. High levels of risk aversion mean that good assets can't be bought and sold, that otherwise sound financial institutions can't access funding markets, and investors aren't prepared to purchase capital in banks. In these situations, the public sector, with its more stable risk preferences and its financial capacity, can play an important stabilising role. There are obviously risks in doing this, but there are also potential benefits to the broader community in which we live. I think there are two main arguments against such involvement. The first is that financial institutions will change the way they operate if they think the public sector will provide support, and that these changes will make the system less stable. The second is that if the public sector is prepared to play such a role, then there's the potential for this role to be misused. And one way this could happen is for the support to be provided to avoid confronting problems in a financial institution, with the result that the problems end up being larger and costly to the taxpayer. Now, both of these concerns are real, and they both need to be taken very seriously. But in my own view, they should not rule out the public sector support in some situations. Concerns about adversely changing behaviour can be addressed through ensuring that shareholders are not bailed out and that the managers of financial institutions are exposed to the downside as well as to the upside. And governance arrangements can be put in place to address concerns about public decision making. The critical question needs to be, what set of policies best maximise social welfare, not what set of policies best minimise the risk of public sector involvement? It may be the case that the answers to these two questions are the same, but I suspect that there are quite a few circumstances where they're not. Once again, the challenge is to get the balance right. So in conclusion, where does all this leave us? I'm afraid that those who want a cast-iron guarantee that financial instability will never be allowed to return, or that the public sector will never have any risk exposure to the financial sector, are likely to be disappointed. As I said at the outset, modern financial systems can be a force of great good, but they are prone to bouts of instability. Attitudes to risk can change abruptly, and the willingness to extend credit and to trade assets can evaporate almost instantly. And over recent years, we've seen too many examples where investors seamlessly moved from seeing risk nowhere to seeing it everywhere. So if we are to live up to the challenge of this conference, global financial stability and prosperity, we need to find a better way of dealing with these swings in risk preferences. First and foremost, this is the responsibility of the managers of financial institutions. But public policy also has an important role to play in designing a system that is strong enough to cope with these swings. And a core set of prudential rules is obviously a critically important element here. But as I argued, rules are never enough. So an understanding of how borrowers and investors view risk and how their decisions are affecting the financial system as a whole is also critically important. Also, we should not lose sight of the fact that the public sector, with its more stable risk appetite, has a balance sheet, and that balance sheet can be used to play a stabilising role. Importantly, if this balance sheet is to be used in this way, we need to be sure that it's done in a way that promotes the welfare of the community at large, rather than just the welfare of the owners and the managers of financial institutions. So thank you very much for your patience in listening, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Phil, it's John Clear from the Financial Review. Are you able to clarify Glenn Stevens' comments yesterday that said the dollar going down? Because, I mean, there's some suggestions that he may have just been having a little bit of a joke, but markets obviously took his comments that the board deliberated for a very long time quite seriously.
Thank you. Well, I can confirm for you that the board did deliberate for a very long time. I can also confirm for you that it always deliberates for a very long time. We start our meetings at 9 a.m. and the monetary policy discussion normally finishes about 12:45, and that's exactly what happened yesterday. So I think the Governor's remarks were, at the beginning of his speech, they were meant to be a light-hearted remark after what he reports to me was a very light-hearted introduction. And I think some people in the financial markets and perhaps the press have misinterpreted the intention of those remarks.
Andrew Stabak, publisher of Australian Banking and Finance magazine, actually Asia Pacific Banking and Finance magazine now. It sounds to me like you've presented a great reason and rationale for a financial services review which is being proposed after the election. Do you agree that there are enough grounds to have another review of our financial services sector? And if so, what sort of filter do you think we could be looking at, a more positive filter, as you've suggested here in this speech?
Mm. Well, I'm not sure my remarks directly or maybe even indirectly touched on the case for a review, but in principle, we should look at the structure and rules in our financial system periodically. It's an incredibly important industry that has a really first-order effect on people's lives. So we need to make sure that we're doing that as efficiently and productively as we possibly can. As to what issues get put on the agenda, that's really going to be an issue for the government. I'd have to say that when I look around the world, the arrangements in Australia, I think, have worked better than many, many other countries. That doesn't mean we can't look for ways to make them work even better, and some of those ways we could do that could be identified through a review.
Just not maybe a question, slightly different to the previous question. As Australia is a member of G20, what's your observation in terms of Australia's contribution to all these new global policies recommendations? We want just to feel proud that we've been a member of a number of committees, organisations, BIS, and other institutions. How do you see Australia's role in post-GFC?
Well, obviously we're going to chair the G20 next year, so that is going to give us the opportunity to shape some of the agendas, and that's going to be kind of a very important opportunity for us. I think in the area of financial regulation, the challenge that the G20 faces now is really to implement what's already been agreed. If you think how long Basel II took to agree, I mean, Basel 3 was agreed very, very quickly, and that was partly because of the political impetus that the G20 gave to this whole process. And I could cite for you other examples where the same has been the case. The challenge I really think now is to implement all that. There's still a lot of hard work to be done. And as we implement it, we need to watch very, very carefully for these side effects, because the amount of change that's been done in the financial sector in such a short period of time is almost unprecedented. We think we broadly understand the effects of that. So I think our main goal here is to implement what has been agreed, monitor how that implementation is going, and change things that need changing as a result of implementation, rather than coming up with yet more reform ideas. I think we've had enough for a while. Thank you.